Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the gift, too. Thank you for the opportunity of fielding some questions. As I said in the last lecture, one of the difficulties about being a visiting lecturer is you run out of lectures to give. Sadly, I could lecture ad nauseam, and it would be your nauseam, but I didn't want to spoil a nice lunch. So I hope you do have some questions. And you know, they needn't just be about bioethics. I'm happy to talk about graduate work and about Oxford and Southern and all the other things. So, as they say in the wedding ceremony, speak now or forever hold your peace. This is the good chairman, you know, who fills his responsibility.
I was wondering during your talk about how you would relate the genetic questions you were addressing to homosexuality. And you spoke of diseases being single gene diseases or multifactorial. Does that relate at all to this question of whether or not homosexuality is genetically predisposed? And if you could just speak to that.
Yes, thank you very much. I want to relate an incident. There was a group in California who were actually all gay, who came up with the idea that they had identified the gay gene. And in the BBC, they had a debate with an extreme right-wing politician, someone from the gay and lesbian Christian movement. There's an oxymoron for you. And myself as the sweet voice of reason in the middle, which was an interesting position to be in. And in the discussion, the gay and lesbian guy said, what we're terrified about is that if people, families, know that their child has a gay gene, they will abort. And Dr. Cook, he turned to me, this is live on radio, he said, Dr. Cook, will you plead with the government that they do not allow people to abort just because they are gay? Now, this was a man who, about 3 or 4 years previously, I had debated on abortion publicly, and he had been then abortion on demand for any and every reason at all. But suddenly, when it came home, it was very much different for him. The science in California was not proven. It was shown that it couldn't actually replicate it. What we know is there are a number of different multifactorial genes which relate to sexuality. And what that means in practice is that there will be predispositions that people have. But these predispositions will depend upon the choices that people make. And so there's no determinism, no physical determinism. If you've got a gene, you will be gay. If you've got a gene, you will be heterosexual. Rather, it's about the company you keep. It's about the way they behave. It's about the choices that you engage in, about the atmosphere you're brought up in. And so that means that we have a great responsibility as parents, but also a great responsibility in the school context, helping young people grow up to make good choices and not to put themselves at risk. Almost all the evidence is that early sexual experience is a key factor in the development of homosexual behavior. And so that's one of the tragedies about what's been happening in the Catholic Church. Usually, sadly, young men have been taken advantage of and introduced into sexual behavior, which has blighted their life. And that's where we can make a real difference, helping young people at that particular stage. We've nothing to fear from the genetics here. No, it's not true. What's very interesting is the person who persuaded the American Psychological Association to remove the term homosexuality from the list of psychological diseases has, in the meantime, changed his mind. And the reason he's changed his mind is because he's been so impressed with the way that Christian counseling groups have helped people change their sexual orientation. Now, we have to beware of what I would call cheap grace here. There are contexts, and I'm thinking particularly of some charismatic brothers and sisters who have promised people that they will be changed from being a raving homosexual to being a raving heterosexual. I'm not sure we should be encouraging anybody to be raving heterosexuals either, but and it hasn't worked. And so I think we need to be hesitant. I think there is the possibility of change. We believe that God is a God who is able to do these things. And certainly the evidence is that it can happen. But that's not to say it's going to be easy. And my own experience in working with people who are homosexual is it's a great deal of effort, a great deal of pain, and that for many of them, they end up saying, I am a non-practicing homosexual. The desires that I have are towards a member of the same sex, but I know that that is something I must not give in to. And so I'm a non-practicing in the way they often draw parallel with alcoholism, non-practicing alcohol. But change is possible.
If we bracket the problems of STDs, HIV, why is homosexuality bad for society? Specifically, how does that undermine marriage?
Yes. Well, I have to beware of being heretical here. I'm often confronted with choices between two evils. And one of the choices is if I'm confronted with a gay person who says, either I'm going to be promiscuous or I'm going to try to live a faithful, committed life, which would you rather have? I would much rather that people were faithful and committed than that they behaved in a promiscuous kind of fashion. So I think in America, where so much is based on rights talk, that it's very difficult if people are in a relationship, and I'm thinking about cohabitation, which is the major problem in the UK. Marriage is disappearing in the UK, and instead cohabitation is becoming the norm. So much so in Scotland, they have what's called a common law marriage. If you share bed and board for 1 year, you are married legally in the eyes of the law and the eyes of the state, and therefore have access to all the benefits with healthcare, insurance, property, and those kinds of things. I think the difficulty is for young people growing up in society. I think that's where the difficulty really arises, that young people model the behaviour they see. And if they are taught from the early stages there is nothing wrong with same-sex relationships, then they will engage in same-sex relationships. Young people are great copyists. I didn't think this was possible until I had two sons of my own. And when we had visitors to the home, you know, my wife would be preparing and I'd go through into the kitchen and come back and I'd hear these two boys telling jokes. I thought, where did they get that from? And what they did, of course, was they copied. The children are great copiers. And I think that's particularly true in sexual behavior. Also true in our culture is that with the breakdown of marriage, and I think that's as serious as anything we should be looking at, the breakdown of marriage and how to seek to prevent that, we're finding that young people are losing confidence in the institution of marriage. And it's interesting that people who don't necessarily share a Christian perspective are seeing that society requires relationships of male and female. Historically, same-sex relationships have never helped a culture flourish. And so that's why people, I think, are building on that. But my concern is for young people. I have a gay friend who he and I debate on radio regularly, and he says, why would we want to get married? Why would we want to join a burning institution? He says, the great thing about us gays is that you've nothing to fear from us because we're all going to die out anyway, because we're not going to breed. But of course, now lesbians are able to have, and indeed some men, if you really want to have the experience of having a baby, we have created an artificial womb which you can insert in your groin, and you can have the experience of carrying that until term. So if you'd like to form an orderly queue afterwards, we can arrange that for you. Sorry.
A quick question.
Of course.
Other than the obvious area of abortion, is there any real consensus on some of the more esoteric ethical questions of like xenoimplantation and IVT, things along that? Is there really consensus among Christian ethicists, or is that still... I don't say being hashed out or being, or is it just agree to disagree?
Yes, I don't think there is that great level of disagreement. I think the differences come in emphases, whether or not you stress one particular thing over and against another. So with xenotransplantation, people are concerned about risk, they're concerned about safety, they're concerned about the abuse of animals, and they're concerned about whether or not there is a species-particular line that we ought not to cross, whether or not God in creating animals and human beings has drawn some lines that we tamper with at our peril. So there are differences in emphasis, but by and large, I'm always amazed at the agreement. And I think that that's one of the things in Christian ethics we ought to be exploring much more. Are there areas where, both with the secular world, are there areas where we can appeal to some kind of common grace, some kind of common ground? When I was leaving the UK to come more permanently to the States, there were two conversations I had, one with a member of parliament and the other with an outrageous colleague in Oxford. And they said, you know, the thing that we are going to miss, each of them said separately, the thing we're going to miss is that so much of what you say is just plain common sense, but nobody else says it. And I agree with 96% of everything you say. The other 4% religious rubbish they found more difficult. But it was interesting that they were saddened that what they saw as a public voice, much involved in the media, was going to be lost. And they just saw it as common sense. So there are areas of agreement. So often we're keen to emphasize the disagreement. But we need to look for agreement, particularly when it comes to legislation, particularly when it comes to creating cultures. You know, I think we should be trying to create more positive cultures rather than negative.
I was thinking not so much between Christian ethicists and secular ethicists,
right,
but actually within kind of the Christian community. I know Dr. Moeller talked a couple of chapels back about the Passion of Christ and how, in some respects, the debates on whether or not, you know, Christ should be portrayed and so forth should happen within the Christian community. And we just need to be ready with the secular community to just talk about our faith and why this had to happen. Is there also kind of a slight dichotomy like that within, I don't know if there really is a Christian ethicist community,
right,
or a bioethicist community, and a secular bioethics?
Yes, I mean, I think in terms of Christian bioethics, I think that what most of us are about is using whatever the issue happens to be, whether xenotransplantation or resource allocation or whatever, as a means of bringing the gospel to bear. I don't think we should just be talking about xenotransplantation on its own. In the end, it's to try to create a challenge to show that there is a Christian ethic, which is something to say. I'm always intrigued when the BBC or ITV phone up and want to do an interview with me. And they come along and they say, what's the big issue about xenotransplantation or resource allocation or this new stem cell research? So you describe what the issue is. And then they say, well, what are the concerns? What are the moral issues at the heart of this? So you then tell what the moral issues and concerns are. And then 99% of the time they say, but you're a Christian. What does Christianity have to say? Now, I don't have to say I'm a spirit-filled Bible believer and here's the answer. No, they are begging me, because they understand that it's so complicated. And I do a lot of work in what you would call high schools, doing conferences around the country in both the public and the private sectors. And there, when you describe to these young people, 17, 18-year-old people going up to college, university, the kind of medical issues, they are desperate to have some kind of answer. Absolutely desperate. And we have an opportunity, particularly, you know, I know that not many of you are doing Christian ethics, but the need there is enormous. The opportunity is enormous. But we need men and women who are really willing to speak at that juncture and to apply the Christian values. Secular society, we were asked a question just coming along from the lecture, whether or not there was antagonism towards me because of my Christian stance. And I have to say that professional people in the specialisms are not at all antagonistic. That doesn't mean they agree with everything I say, but they recognize that I have earned the right to say it. You know, in missions work, we encourage people to go into a culture, understand the culture, and then to speak appropriately. It's the same in that medical, bioethical kind of world. You have to show doctors, nurses, professional groups, genetic society, whatever, that you understand them, that you have some appreciation of the questions that they face, and then that you're able to give them something. They are looking for some input there, and that's an opportunity we have.
Thank you.
Would you then speak to some of your successes that you've had in influencing high-level officials in government, science, the academy, people who have actually been persuaded by your
argument? Yes, let me give you just two examples. I remember doing a program about euthanasia. People were dying to take part. In this program, I was presenting a case for the sanctity of human life. And afterwards, the person who writes the leaders for the Times of London said that their mind had been changed by what I said, and that the leaders now in the Times would show much greater sympathy towards that. I don't normally read the Times, but I read some of them afterwards. And it was interesting to see how anti-euthanasia the newspaper became. Now, I don't think I was the only influence, but certainly the editor was saying this was something that was really quite fundamental. The other area was that the House of Lords set up a committee to look at the whole question of persistent vegetative state, mercy killing, and so on. And I was invited to give evidence to them and spent an afternoon presenting evidence and written evidence, all the rest of it. And the day before the report was due to be produced, I had a phone call from the chairman, and he said, the report is coming out tomorrow. I think you'll be rather pleased with it, was what he said. Well, when the report came out, I read it, and in the central part there were 3-4 pages of moral argument. And I thought, this is very familiar, really. And it was familiar because it was really just my thing, just written round and, you know, adapted and edited. But it was basically that same kind of position. This was a group which was made up of 16 people, 8 who were in favour of euthanasia and 8 who were opposed. So it was a very balanced committee. When the committee gave its final report, all 16 said no legislation for euthanasia. The risk is too great, and we must not allow society to go down there. So that was, you know, these are not, in the scheme of things, great achievements, but they are showing that you can make a difference. You can make a difference. And people are affected. I remember going to the railway station in Oxford one day and said to the guy at the ticket counter, return to Paddington, please. He said, are you on the radio? I said, well, yes, sometimes. He said, you're on the Model Maze. I said, well, that's right. He says, you're Dr. David Cook. I want to shake your hand. And all from a return to Paddington. And so you were a bit fearful. What did I say before I said return to Paddington? People not only recognize the voice, they actually remember things that you said. I was invited to a lunch like this in one of the colleges. They have a custom, you just sit next to the person who's already seated. So I went in, sat down with this guy, and my host introduced me to him. And he said, are you that guy from Green College that's on the radio? I said, well, yes, sometimes. He said, you said... And I'm thinking, when did I say this? And I worked out it was about 6 years previously in a 3-minute broadcast in morning radio, which is nationally syndicated. I had made this statement as part of a thing. This guy remembered that I was wrong, then spent half an hour trying to persuade me of how wrong and misunderstanding the issue that I was. And we spent a happy 45 minutes having a discussion. From a discussion which was years before. And so we often underestimate the influence that you can have. It's a Scottish accent that gets them every time.
Question. Following up on that, can you discuss the present state of ethics in Southern Baptist Convention or in evangelicalism here in the United States? Specifically, are we effectively impacting our culture, and do you have any suggestions, course corrections?
Well, how long is a piece of string? The question about Christian ethics in the Southern Baptist is where. The response to whether or not we're impacting our current culture and generation, no. One of the things that frightens me most about coming and being in the States is I look at the churches which, in terms of numbers, in terms of wealth, in terms of ability, are absolutely enormous. But I look at the impact in terms of culture, I look at radio, I look at television, I look at legislation, and I do not see that kind of impact. What I do see is a separatism, whereby, yes, you have Christian programs, but you're not into the mainstream. We really in the UK have tried to be mainstream broadcasting so that the Christian voice was heard at the table. Sometimes that's been a historical argument. How can you understand a culture without that? Sometimes it's a level of analysis. We can offer you some insight into what's going on. Sometimes it's trying to bring a different perspective and a challenge. And I just pray earnestly for a generation of Christian ethicists in the Southern Baptist who will, first of all, inform the church. My fear is that so often what happens in Southern Baptist circles is that people know where they stand, but they don't know why they stand there. You know, like this question about homosexual marriage. you know, I'm not sure that there's a lot of thinking about the issue going on. What is it we actually believe in marriage? What's so special about Christian marriage over and against state marriage? Do we think that to be married is all the same thing? Or do we think there's something about Christians being married in the body of Christ which is fundamentally different from two people going to a state setting and being legally married? And ought we not to emphasize that difference far more and make a stand there? So I think we need to, first of all, to inform our people, to help them think this through. Secondly, we need to challenge society. We've really failed in interpenetrating society. And part of that is in terms of writing, in terms of speaking. I'll give you an example. People in the UK, the thing they're looking for is cheap radio. And cheap radio is phone-in programs. There are endless phone-in programs. And of course, phone-in programs only work because people phone in. Now, I know hundreds of Christians who are listening to a program say, oh, that's terrible, I should phone in, and they never do. So I've been trying to encourage Christians to phone in and programs. And they say, oh, but people will make a fool of me. So I say, all right then, write down what it is you want to say. And as soon as they say we're looking for calls in this, phone in, because it's the first 20 minutes when nobody bothers to phone in. They're dredging people up. So you phone in at the very beginning, and they'll say, what do you want to say? And you read what you want to say. And they'll say, all right then, you're going on air. So you go on air, and they'll say, here's, you know, Brent Kelly from Southern Baptist Seminary. What do you have to say? Brent Kelly reads what he has to say. And then the presenter might try and make a fool of you. He might say, well, you know, that's all very fine, but what about this and this and this? And what Brent Kelly then should say is, look, I don't know anything about that. But what I do know is, and you read again what you've written. Now you've said it twice on radio. And on national radio, that can be very impacting. I was once doing a program with the world leader of the World Euthanasia Society. And this was a three-hour program live on radio for the whole evening. And after about 25 minutes, almost an hour, I said, you know, this is live. This program is uneven. It's totally uneven because all the calls that we're having are from people who are in favor of mercy killing, and nobody is negative. And the presenter became very defensive. He said, well, all we're doing is we're reflecting the people who call in. And I said, well, I hope there are people out there who are listening who believe that this is fundamentally wrong who will call in. Within 5 minutes, the calls changed. And then we had almost 2 hours of nothing but anti-euthanasia calls coming in from all over the country because people needed permission. Now, why do they need permission to phone in? You know, there's an opportunity there. We need to enable Christian people to do that. We need ourselves to be involved in that. And if you do it and you do well, they'll like it. And they'll say, well, why don't you come in and do something for us, something a little bit more, and the opportunity grows and grows. Broadcasting depends on broadcasting. You need a lot of people. And to keep all these channels in America going, you need people who have got something to say and can say it well and can say it positively. You are tomorrow.
This is an appropriate question for your field. It's online in the ethics field, so I'm kind of a new person to this. I know you deal with the technologies and you make yourself aware in your circles of the biotechnologies that are out there, and we're trying to figure out what to say to the people who are asking permission to use these technologies, yes, no, or limit them. But what about the people who aren't asking for permission? So terrorism and all this that's going on in the world's a different place. What, from your vantage point, what are the big issues with bioterrorism, the idea of bad guys using these technologies in new ways unimaginable, you know, and what's on the forefront there?
On the forefront there are really viral infections, whether it's going to be polluting air, polluting water, polluting food. That's where the real risk comes. You know, we have our glasses topped up with water here. How do you know that water is pure? You turn on the tap, water comes out. You go for a walk in the fresh air. How do you know that the air you're breathing is not affected? And that's what's frightening. It's frightening that you could hire, you know, an airplane out at Love Field. You could fill it up with any kind of chemical detergent. You could spray the air, and people walking along would have no understanding, no knowledge of any risk, and be affected. That's where the difficulty, that's where it's coming. And these will be viral infections. And they'll be viral infections which will not just kill on contact. They will be slow moving, so that when you go home, you will infect your family. When you go into to work, when you go into the grocery store, you will infect everybody you meet. You get on a plane to fly to DC or to Florida, and you infect the people there, everybody on the plane. They then infect everybody else, and so it multiplies. That's where the real risk in bioterrorism comes. But it will be viral infections, and they will not be immediately fatal. What they want is to make the healthcare system collapse. They want to make the economics collapse. So they don't just want to kill people, they want actually the system, the structures to collapse. So they'll be slow acting, and people will get slower and more ill. The health services won't be able to cope with it, the finances won't be able to cope with it, everything will be affected. That's where I think the risk really lies.
Dr. Cook, just sort of a two-part question, but connected together. In your work as an ethicist and your life, who are the individuals that have played maybe a great influence on your work that you've either read, have known, have worked with, and in connection with that, who are the ethicists besides yourself that you think right now are addressing the most crucial issues in society, not just from an evangelical standpoint, but from a national standpoint?
Yeah. This is a difficult question for me because it's one of our great cultural differences. People often say to me, well, who is your mentor? Give me your idea of your mentors. And I find that a difficult question because I like to think I can learn from everybody. And that's what I've tried to do, whether they're Christian, non-Christian. I've looked for this individual to teach me something and something I can learn. Sometimes you learn negatively as well as learn positively. In terms of my own ethical thinking, I've been much influenced by a tradition from Bradley and Bosanquet. Bradley was an idealist, and he wrote a book called My Station and Its Duties, which now sounds very twee, very old-fashioned, very formal. But it gave, I think, an emphasis on responsibilities rather than rights. And that's something which I think we have been misled in our culture, your culture, my culture, by that whole rights emphasis. And I think somebody like Bradley, if we could ever write in a way that people actually read him and understood him, then that would help us. So he's been a very great influence. I think that Lou Smeads has been somebody who has tried very hard to address from a Christian perspective. And Tielecke and Barthes, in their own kinds of ways, I find their reflection, their analysis of moral issues, their perception, not that I always agree with them, but I find it challenging and a challenge to make me think through. There's also a well-known atheist called Anthony Flew. And Anthony Flew has a lovely line which I try to follow in my writing and teaching and broadcasting, which is, he says, we must write and speak not so that people may understand, but so they must understand. And if you want a motto for your dissertation writing, that is an excellent kind of thing. Write so that people can really understand. They must understand. There's no dubiety, there's no misunderstanding. They actually understand what the argument is and how it develops. I wish that we had more and more people who were engaging. What's happening, as with so much of culture, is that people are privatizing. And there are very few people. I was brought up in a generation where there were well-known columnists who wrote on anything and everything. Now people don't like unless they're an expert. And that's very difficult. I remember being invited to take part in a debate with a doctor who had written in a medical journal called The Lancet, and he'd written that Jesus didn't die. It was an old heresy, you know, that Jesus had just fainted and all the rest of it. But here he was giving this new kind of version. BBC phoned me up and said, we'd like you to debate with this doctor. I said, look, you need Tom Wright, somebody who knows something about the New Testament. You know, what I know, you can write in a postage stamp and still have stuff left over. They said, no, we want you to do it. And I said, well why do we? Oh, we think you'll be good in debate, you see. Well, that, of course, meant a sleepless night worrying about what I was going to say to this doctor. So anyway, we go live on BBC, and there's a big build-up, and they say, we have Dr. So-and-so here who's written in this well-known medical journal. Doctor, tell us what you think. So he tells us. And then the presenter comes to me and says, we have Dr. David Cook from Oxford University. And Dr. Cook, what do you think of this? And I said, well, I'm always worried when a doctor diagnoses a patient that he hasn't seen over the telephone, this is a remarkable doctor who's given me a diagnosis of a patient who died 2,000 years ago, he's never seen, and all the rest of it. Can I really trust this doctor? And so the guy said to the doctor, what do you have to say to that? And the doctor said, blah, 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 blah. Nothing to say to that. We need people who can think on their feet, but we also need people who can think and write carefully, who can actually sustain a careful and a long argument. And it's not always the quick and the witty, though sometimes you do need that, but it's also the people who can just keep plowing away and actually present substantial kinds of arguments. I mean, I have a good friend, Oliver O'Donovan, who writes very well in the Christian world, but Oliver won't broadcast. He won't write for the popular media. And if you've ever spent any time with him, you'll understand that that's a good choice on his part. And he's quite clear why he does that. And the number of invitations I get, which are, O'Donovan rejects, are quite remarkable. I have no pride. I accept these things. You know?
Presenting the same ethical dilemma versus the embryo, and the counter argument to the usefulness of adult cells is that the others are more useful.
Right. This is a scientific debate, first of all, about whether or not stem cells, and by stem cells, what we're talking about is here you have an egg, and you withdraw the nucleus from the egg, so you keep the outer ring, and you can replace that nucleus with something else. And indeed, what they're hoping to be able to do is to replace part of the nucleus. So the part that develops the liver, the part that develops the kidney, the part that develops other organs, you will actually be able to replicate that from an individual. That's the hope. That's what they're trying to do. Now, the claim thus far in the scientific debate is that, yes, you can take stem cells from adults or you can take them from embryonic material. Now, by embryonic material, you mean both the afterbirth, we're talking about the umbilical cord, and we're talking about the embryo himself or herself. So there are a number of sources of stem cells. But we're also talking about adults, a hair of your head, a piece of your skin. We will be able to remove stem cells from that. The difficulty, it's claimed, is that the stem cells from the umbilical cord, from the embryo, are what they call plenipotentiary. They are able to do many things. They have more potential. They're more flexible because they are not preformed. Whereas when you get an adult stem cell, it tends to be preformed. Now, I think this is a scientific question. Scientific question because where have we been putting the resources? Well, because of fertility treatment, we put all the money into embryonic research. We haven't put anything like the money into adult stem cells. And so I think it's a lack of will and a lack of finance that actually is making it look like science, but it isn't science at all. So I think that we could easily, and what Bush, I think, should have done, was actually said, but we will give money for adult stem cell research. And that would have given a boost to the stem cell work from adult material. And I think that we will find that we will be able to do much, much more with that than we can at the present time. So I am more hopeful that we will be able to use adult stem cells. The difficulty from the Christian perspective is that in order to get sufficient stem cells, you have to produce lots, lots of embryos. If you're going to produce lots of embryos, what you have to do is you have to make women superovulate, you have to produce many kinds of eggs, you have to fertilize lots of eggs, and that means that generations of children, or what would become children, other things being equal, are being used. Why are they being used? They're being used in order to do research. They're not people, here's a couple who want to have a child, and so perhaps they're finding difficulty, they go along, they have some medical treatment, and the embryos or the eggs which are taken and then fertilized are for that couple to grow a family. We're not talking about that. We're now talking about producing, in like battery hens, batches of embryos simply for research. The question then that society has to ask is how are we prepared to treat human material? Do we believe that this is human, first of all? It's certainly not human. It's interesting that, you know, people have the debate about is it a person, isn't a person. But actually, I think that we'd be far better to concentrate on humanity. This is human material. And other things being equal, this embryo would become the same kind of human being as you and I are. So there's a continuity, which is why Isaiah, Jeremiah, the psalmist, John the Baptist, Jesus, all of these biblical examples emphasize continuity. And that's where we should be putting the emphasis. I think the personhood argument is never going to carry. Never going to carry because you have a different understanding of what is a human being. But you don't have a different understanding of what is human. And so the question is whether or not human material should have respect. And that's why yesterday when I was talking about the way in which the Muslim and the Jewish faith respond to dead bodies is very interesting. Because here it's not living human material, but dead human material, which is still treated with respect. I remember when my father died, I was just a young boy. And then I was sitting in the funeral car following the hearse to the cemetery where he was going to be buried. And there was a parade of the Boys Brigade, which is a youth organization, and they all wear a uniform. And as we went past, every single young man took his hat off. And I thought, why are you doing that? You don't know who this person in the coffin is. You just know this is a funeral cortege. They were showing respect. And so there is a very deep human respect for humanity. And so I think we should be building on that respect for humanity. Stem cell research, I think, has been overhyped. I don't think scientifically it's going to be as easy to do as people imagine. Thirdly, I think it may be far more costly. Secondly, it may be more costly. Thirdly, it may actually have negative effects that we don't yet realize. And so I think that the biochemistry and the biology have a long way to go. But if we really want to give a fair crack at the whip, we ought to put the money into adult stem cell research, because I think that's going to be as fruitful in the end. There'll still be all the other risks with it, but I think that that would remove the focus of the debate at the present time.
Quick question. Talking about focusing on the humanity, isn't there, though, the potential of taking that too far and saying, well, there shouldn't be organ transplants because this is that person's organs, that person's material, and therefore we shouldn't touch or do any, you know, no autopsy, nothing along that line?
Yes. I think that I am more and more concerned about organ transplantation in the sense that I think that we're in danger of creating such pressure on individuals they have to allow their body to be used in that kind of way. I think rather it's donation. It's very interesting the language we use is about organ donation. And I think there's a world of difference between giving a gift. Greater love hath no man than this, than he lay down his life for his friend. And so there's a world of difference between giving blood, giving organs, as opposed to having the government take them or selling them, which is the other concern, commercialization here. You're right. In doing a good thing, there's always dangers that follow. The wisdom has to be in so constructing the rules for organ donation that we preserve the integrity and the freedom of the individual. Not everybody. 17% of people in society are willing to donate. That seems to be the given figure. You can push it up to 26 by tremendous campaigns, but it's really hard to do. The running figure is about 17%. That's 1 in 5 people are willing actually to donate. 46% say they're willing, but only 17% actually deliver. One more. Total sense. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the lunch and thank you for the gift.